is the truth. See you tomorrow, gang. Have a good one.
And now, from Washington, the Inside Scoop. All the news the government does not want you to hear. Now, here's your host on the Inside Scoop, Mark Levine.
Good afternoon, America. Welcome to the Inside Scoop. If you saw some of the testimony of General Petraeus yesterday, you saw a lot of frustration on the faces of the senators. Mostly the Democrats, but even some Republicans, too, were, let's just say, frustrated by General Petraeus' failure to give any kind of real answer. When will the troops leave? Well, I don't know. Guess it depends on conditions. Are we succeeding? Oh, absolutely we're succeeding. What are we succeeding in doing? Well, it's kind of hard to say. If you go through the history of this conflict, of course, you see at the beginning the enemy apparently was Saddam Hussein. George Bush intimated that Saddam Hussein had worked with al-Qaeda. That didn't turn out to be true. And that he had weapons of mass destruction. That didn't turn out to be true. But the goal was to remove Saddam Hussein, who was a bad man. And then, no, the enemy was al-Qaeda in Iraq. And now we have a new enemy, Iran, apparently aiding Shia militias. When will it ever end? Who are the players? And what do Iraqis think of all of this? Well, to answer these questions, I've invited a really terrific guest. His name is Ed Gerard. He is the Iraqi consultant for the American Friends Services Committee. Ra'ed, welcome to the Inside Scoop.
Having me. Thanks so much for having me on your show.
Thank you very much for coming. Let me start just by getting a little bit of your history here. You were born in Iraq?
Yeah, I was born in Baghdad, and I spent most of my life there.
How were you there up into and including the American occupation, or did you leave before then?
I was there before and during and after the initial invasion in 2003, and I left after that. I moved to the U.S. in 2005.
So you're one of the 2 million Iraqi refugees from the country.
Yeah, I guess like I'm one of the. Yeah, I mean now the number is more 2.5 million Iraqis who were forced to leave their country.
2.5 million. Now, you were from Baghdad then. You're from Baghdad?
Yeah, I'm originally from Baghdad. My mother is from the south, so she's from Hilda.
And pardon me for asking this, but it does seem to matter in the context of the Iraqi debate and factions today, but are you Shia or Sunni or some mixture?
Yeah, I mean, you know, these questions are very new to Iraqis because people never thought about these things before 2003. I'm actually half Sunni and half Shiite.
Well, then you are then clearly the typical Iraqi, half Shia, half Sunni. And when I think about it, this tremendous ethnic conflict, which, as you point out, people didn't even talk about under Saddam Hussein's reign very much. I assume that there are many people like yourself that are half Shia, half Sunni that are caught in the middle of this awful civil war.
Well, not really, because from an Iraqi point of view, the actual conflict that is happening is not a conflict between Sunnis and Shiites. There are some Sunnis and Shiites fighting against other Sunnis and Shiites because of political reasons. So I don't think people who are half Sunni, half Shiite, like myself, have this feeling that they are caught in the middle in a religious war or a sectarian war. Because in Iraq, people realize that the conflict is not based on ancient hatred between Iraqis based on their sectarian or ethnic background. It's more a political and economic conflict. That is putting a minority of Iraqis who are Sunnis and Shiites backed by the U.S. Against the majority of Iraqis who are Sunnis and Shiites as well. I think the events of Basra last week were an excellent example of how the conflict is not sectarian or ethnic. We saw how Shiites attacked other Shiites in the south.
Obviously, well, that's true, and that's very interesting. I'd like you to explain to me that the Iraqi government is majority Shia, like the majority of the country, and yet the Iraqi government ordered its troops, who really didn't function, and he ended up, I guess, ordering American troops, Prime Minister Maliki did, to fight against Muqtada al-Sadr in the south. What's really going on here?
So what's going on is that the Iraqi government it has two major branches, and both branches has Sunnis and Shiites in them. The executive branch, where Mr. al-Maliki comes from, there are Sunnis and Shiites in the executive branch, and Kurds who control it, and these Sunnis and Shiites are backed by the U.S. And there are other Sunnis and Shiites in the other branches of the government, like al-Sadr movement and other Shiites are represented in the legislative branch or the parliament. So what happened in the south last week, why I was referring to it as a good example, because you can see how political is it. The Iraqi government passed a law to organize the next election, and the next election will decide how the future of the country will look like, whether Iraq will continue to be one united state, or whether it will partition and have Sunnistan and Shiastan. Now, the Sunnis and Shiites in the executive branch, backed by the U.S., started preparing for the next election a few hours after this law passed. But instead of sending, people to put advertisements in TVs or to start working on enhancing the deteriorating services, they actually sent 50,000 troops, 50,000 Shiite militias to attack, their Shiite rivals in the south. Now,
so you see this as a political thing, as a way of the government taking control prior to the October provincial elections?
The Shiites who are in the executive branch want to partition the country and have a Shia stand in the south that doesn't belong to the central government in Baghdad, while the Shiites outside the executive branch, like al-Sadr or al-Fadila party, they are nationalists, so they are for keeping Iraq with one central government, against partitioning and against the U.S. occupation.
Now, hang on, Red. This is very interesting to me. I want to make sure I got the point. What you're saying is that the government of Iraq really wants to partition the country, while al-Sadr and others does not want to partition the country. Is that right, or am I misunderstanding you?
Yeah, you are understanding the right way. The Sunnis and Shiites in the government, in the executive branch, Mr. al-Maliki and Talibani, the president, and al-Hashimi, the vice president, these Sunnis and Shiites and Kurds are for partitioning Iraq into a Kurdistan, a Sunnistan, and a Shiastan. But the other Sunnis and Shiites and seculars and Christians outside the executive branch, mostly represented in the legislative branch, like Mr. al-Sadr or al-Fadila party or other parties, they are against partitioning and they are against the occupation to stay on the long run. So that's the real reason for the conflict that is happening there. And this answers the first question of why don't people like myself feel that we are caught in the middle, because it's such a war between Sunnis and Shiites. Which Sunnis are we talking about? Al-Qaeda, or the vice president who is a separatist, or the Islamic army who are a part of the armed resistance? Which Shiites are we talking about? Al-Sadr and Al-Fadila and other nationalists, or the Supreme Council and Da'wah and other separatists?
That's the problem. It's all very complicated. There are so many different groups, and it's hard for at least an American to understand who's fighting whom. And it seems that America is arming all sides. Is that right? And Iran, too, I guess, is arming a number of Shias.
Is taking the side systematically of some Sunnis and some Shiites against other Sunnis and other Shiites. The Sunnis and Shiites who the U.S. government has allied itself with are the ones in the executive branch, the separatists, and the Sunnis and Shiites that the U.S. has considered its enemies are the ones in the legislative branch or the nationalists. So politically, it's not vague or confusing. The U.S. government knows what it's doing. It has been supporting five parties in the executive branch, and these five parties are Sunnis and Shiites and Kurds, against the rest of the parties and the rest of the Iraqi population, who are Sunnis and Shiites and Kurds as well. So they realize that it's not a sectarian or religious war, but they say that because they want to push that myth that a U.S. withdrawal will cause the sky to fall and Sunnis and Shiites to kill each other in a sectarian civil war. Now, this is something that Iraqis don't believe in, and they don't buy, because they know that the reason for the conflict now is not sectarian differences. The reason is a foreign occupation systematically against the majority of Sunnis and Shiites.
Now, it's interesting, a lot of things you said there I want to explore. First of all, the issue of a minority. This government in Iraq that the United States is supporting, in your view, is not representing a majority of Iraqis?
The executive branch that the U.S. is supporting does not represent neither the majority of Iraqis nor the majority of the only elected body in the government, which is the parliament. In the legislative branch.
How did they get there? I thought they were elected. They weren't elected, the executive branch?
No, it wasn't. Iraq is in a parliamentarian system. So Iraqis, millions of Iraqis, including myself, voted for the parliament. And then the parliament was supposed to vote or select some people to represent them or the ruling party, the winner parties in the executive branch. But what happens now is that the five parties that lost the election, the five parties that have a minority in the only elected body in the government, in the parliament, running the executive branch. So
I need you to explain this to me, because I don't understand. You're telling me there are five parties in parliament that lost the election that represent a minority of Iraqis, and yet they're controlling the executive branch?
Exactly.
How does that work?
The 12 parties that won the election, the Sunnis and Shiites who won the election, control the majority of the legislative branch, are not represented in the executive branch. And that's why, because the reason is the U.S. government's intervention in the selection process. Just let me give you an example to prove this fact.
Okay.
For example, the oil law. We know the oil law that the Bush administration has been trying to push through Iraq.
Yes.
During the last year, right? The
yes.
oil law passed through the executive branch in 2 days. Because the executive branch is led by the five Bush allies. So the Sunnis and Shiites in the executive branch rubber stamped the oil law and passed it. Now, the legislative branch, or the Iraqi parliament, has been resisting the oil law for the last year and a half, because they think that the oil law is a threat to the country's future, to Iraq's to Iraqi territorial integrity and to the Iraqi sovereignty. So you can see that people who are in control, in charge of the only elected body of the Iraqi government, are the nationalists who are against partitioning, against privatization of Iraq's natural resources, and against the occupation. But these voices are not represented in the executive branch at all. The five parties that control the executive branch control only 110 or 120 seats in the Iraqi parliament, which is less than the majority.
Well, Brian, let me ask you this. Why can't the parliament have a vote of no confidence and use its majority power to get rid of this executive branch?
Two reasons. The first reason is that the 12 parties who represent the majority of the parliament are against having any type of political or sectarian represented executive branch. They don't want to be a part of the executive branch to start with. They want a technocrat government that does not represent political parties. The second reason is that they don't have, to start with, they don't have enough votes to bring a vote of no confidence. They don't control two-thirds of the legislative branch. They control less than that.
Does it take two-thirds? I mean, in the British system, for example, all it takes is a majority to vote down a government. Does the Iraqi constitution require a two-thirds vote?
Yes.
Interesting. See, I didn't realize that. Now, when is the next national election? I know the provincial elections in October. Will they affect the parliament, or do we have to wait for the next national elections in Iraq?
The next provincial elections are actually more important than the next national elections, in the sense of the provinces having the final say in partitioning Iraq or keeping Iraq united with one central government. If the five parties in the executive branch manage to win three provinces, for example, in the south, if they manage to win three out of the nine provinces of the south, they will be allowed to create a new region in the south, like Kurdistan in the north, that doesn't have any, or like, you know, reduce the authority of the central government. If they fail to win three provinces in the south, they will lose. They will their project of separation or partitioning will collapse completely. Now, according to all of the indicators that are coming from Iraq, it seems that the five parties in the executive branch will lose miserably in the south and in the middle, and that's why they leaked out and sent 50,000 troops to Basra to try to kill their political rival.
So in your view, al-Sadr's view, which it sounds like I think you are in sympathy with, is that there should be one Iraq, that it should not be partitioned, and that this is really what the fight is about. Is that fair?
The Sadr movement and al-Qabila party and other nationalist Shiites are against partitioning, and they are against that. They have been against that for years now.
And I understand that because the Shia are a majority in Iraq. But what about the Sunnis? They are a minority. Aren't they more supportive of partition? Aren't they more afraid of a Shia-run central government?
No. Just let me finish my answer of the question.
Okay.
The Shiites in the south, the majority of the Shiites, around 70% of the Iraqi Shiites, are against partitioning. Not because they think they are the majority or they want to, you know, eat a bigger piece of the cake, but because they have a feeling of belonging to Iraq as one united country and to back that as their central government. So it's not an issue of who will end up dominating or not dominating. If they actually wanted, if it was true that the Shiites in Iraq were planning to dominate, or they want to take the natural resources, they would have just split from Iraq, partitioned, and took all of the oil in the south for themselves. But the majority of Iraqis, whether they were Sunnis or Shiites, are against partitioning because they believe that they want to live in one country that is mixed and that is not represented based on people's sex or religious background, but based on people's capability to rule Iraq and build Iraq based on their qualifications. So I don't think there is a real anxiety by people who come from a Sunni or Shiite background or mixed people about who the president or the prime minister would be or what his background is. The real anxiety is whether this president or prime minister will keep Iraq stubborn and independent and put Iraqis who want to live united and mixed in charge of ruling the country to stop the growing feeling of sectarian tension in Iraq. So I don't think that there is...
Well, let me ask you about one more group that we haven't discussed, and that is the Kurds, because even if the majority of Shia and Sunni do not want partition, I would think perhaps the Kurds do. They seem to have been apart from Iraq for some time. They had pretty much an independent state under Saddam Hussein, even after the first Gulf War, and they seem to be more independent from the rest of Iraq. Do you agree?
The Iraqi Kurds actually historically had their specificity. even before the first Gulf War, Iraqi Kurds had a self-autonomy region in the north, and they ran their own business by themselves. The former Iraqi constitution was the only constitution in the region who considered Kurdish as a second language, official language, and gave the Kurds the right to for self-autonomy. Now, that said, the right to self-autonomy is different than the movement of the separation. The two Kurdish ruling parties are separatists, actually. They want to split from Iraq and create an independent nation state. But according to the polls that come from the Kurdish region, there is a majority of the Kurds who are against seceding from Iraq. 50% or more of the Kurds are against seceding, but of course the majority of Kurds are for keeping the self-autonomy for themselves. Now, this is something that I don't think many Iraqis disagree on. Even the most hardcore nationalist Iraqis still believe in the right of Kurds to self-rule their region, and without following the central government on a micro-management scale. But of course, they are against Kurdistan to secede and withdraw from Iraq, stop being a part of the Iraqi territory.
Right, Ed, General Petraeus argued yesterday that if American troops leave Iraq, there will be chaos, there will be war, there will be a lot of sectarian violence. What's your position on that?
Well, this is what the administration has been saying to one specific constituency in the U.S. There are usually two different excuses given to justify a long-term intervention in Iraq by the U.S. government. The U.S. constituency that tends to be more to the right or more conservative is usually targeted by theories like security intervention. The government tells them that staying in Iraq is good for American security because we should, fight them over there instead of them fighting us over here or whatever they use.
That's what the president keeps saying.
Exactly.
As strange
now,
as it sounds,
reaching to like America, like the left constituency and the people who are more liberal, the justification of the occupation and prolonging the occupation tends to be more based on this humanitarian intervention theory. So they say if we pulled out from Iraq, the sky will fall and Sunnis and Shiites will kill each other. Now,
and you don't believe that will happen?
I don't believe that, and the majority of Iraqis don't believe that. 70% of the Iraqi public, according to the latest polls that came a couple of weeks ago, are still demanding that the U.S. should completely withdraw out of their country.
I want to repeat that because it's very important what you just said. I just want to repeat that because it's very important what you just said. 70% of Iraqis in the latest poll said they want the United States to make a complete withdrawal from Iraq. I just wanted to reiterate that because it's a very strong point. Please go ahead.
Now, 70% of Iraqis, according to ORD, polling and research British organization, want the U.S. to completely withdraw. And the more important than that, the majority of the Iraqi parliamentarians, who are the only represent the only elected body in Iraq, support a complete U.S. withdrawal that leaves no permanent bases and no U.S. troops or no U.S. Private contractors. Now, the historic precedent shows us that whenever the Iraqis kicked out their foreign occupiers or when their foreign occupiers withdrew in the last century, Sunnis and Shiites didn't attack each other and kill each other. In fact, they worked together to get rid of the foreign occupiers. The latest history of Iraq in the last few months, after the coalition troops withdrew from Basra in the south, Basra was actually ruled by a majority of the Sunnis and Shiites who are nationalists, who control Basra and other southern cities.
Let me ask you this, go ahead. We only have a few minutes left, and go ahead, real quick.
After the coalition forces withdrawal, violence dropped 90%, according to the International Herald Tribune. So you can see that, you know, in the short-term history and long-term history, there are no precedents that the foreign occupation saved Iraqis from each other. And we shouldn't forget that the foreign occupation has caused the death of 1 million Iraqis in the last 5 years and the displacement of another 5 million. So we're not speaking about some peacekeeping force that keeping it there is optional. We're speaking about a massacre that is happening, that's destroying the country. And the Iraqis want to stop this massacre from happening by ending the foreign occupation and getting their country back.
Right, let me ask you, and we don't have too much time left, and I want to ask you two more questions before you go. The first has to do with Baghdad, your old home city. There were charts shown by General Petraeus at the hearing yesterday to show that Baghdad is more ethnically segregated than it used to be, that there used to be a wide mixture of Shia and Sunni, but today they pretty much live in separate neighborhoods. I'm wondering if you agree with that. That is true. Maybe you don't agree that is true, but if you agree that is true, and if so, what's actually going on there?
It's true. The last 5 years, Iraqis witnessed one of the biggest ethnic and sectarian cleansing campaigns in the history of the region. The 5 million Iraqis who were displaced in the last 3 years were not displaced because of violence. They were displaced because of a political agenda that wants.
Who has that political agenda? Who is separating the neighborhoods in Baghdad? Is the United States helping that effort? What's going on there?
When the five Iraqi separatist parties came into power in 2003, and they wanted to create a Shiistan and a Sunnistan. Many Iraqis told them that they were crazy because there are 2 million Sunnis in the south and 2 million Shiites in the middle. That plan wouldn't work. So they have been fixing this problem for them in the last 4 or 5 years. Now, while the U.S. wasn't involved, there were no documentation of the U.S. involved directly in ethnic and sectarian cleansing, the U.S. has been supporting and protecting and backing the Iraqi sectarian forces who were committing this ethnic cleansing. In addition to that, there were some few actually documented cases in Basra where the British Army was forced red-handed. Some British special operation forces were forced red-handed in Basra, wearing like Arabs and aggravating sectarian tension by putting some bombs in Shiite mosques and saying they are Sunnis or whatever. So there has been a huge campaign, and it separated Baghdad. It cut Baghdad based on sectarian and ethnic differences. But these campaigns, putting Iraqis against each other sectarianly and ethnically, did not reach to the Iraqi institutions, and that was what I was referring to in the beginning of the interview. Institutionally, but in the government and in the parties and all of the political and social leaders, we don't see any type of of sectarian or religious separation or grouping. The grouping is actually purely political and economic, and that's why Iraqis don't think that once the U.S. withdraws, that violence will go up or a sectarian war will start, because a sectarian war is not happening to start with.
It's very interesting, and I did promise you I would let you go after a half hour, but I have one more question for you, and then I promise to let you go, and that is the role of Iran. General Petraeus was constantly talking about Iran aiding radical Shia militias, and he seemed to imply that if they were not behind al-Sadr, that they were behind a number of Shia groups that were attacking Americans and so forth in the Green Zone. What do you think Iran is doing And is it constructive or destructive? And what should be done in Iraq about Iranian influence?
Now, while I think the majority of the Iraqi people and Iraqi politicians and Iraqi analysts, including myself, believe that Iran is interfering in Iraq in a negative way, I think that all of us believe this because of different reasons. What the Bush administration is trying to portray the situation, they are trying to say that Iran is supporting some group and the U.S. is supporting some other group. These groups are fighting against each other. While in reality, Iraqis realize that the groups that Iran is supporting are exactly the same groups that the U.S. is supporting in Iraq. There are two political parties that are allied with both Iran and the U.S., the Supreme Council, led by Mr. Al-Hakim, and Al-Dawa Party, led by the Prime Minister, Mr. Al-Maliki. These are two parties that were either created by the Iranian government or hosted by the Iranian government in the last 20 years. Now, Iran's support to these two parties is very negative because these parties are responsible for the violence and ethnic and sectarian violence and ethnic and sectarian cleansing that has been happening in the last few years. This does not justify a war against Iran, because attacking Iran will not, stopping the Iranian intervention doesn't happen through attacking Iran. Stopping the Iranian intervention happens through stopping the alliance with the Iranian parties in Iraq. The point that I'm trying to say is that Iran is interfering in a negative way, but what the Bush administration is trying to do is not to stop the bad Iranian influence, but rather to justify a new war on Iran. Now, all of that said, Iran, there are many Iraqi groups that are not allied with Iran, like, for example, Al-Sadr group, but who have Iranian weapons, obviously. Or they have found Iranian weapons with them. But saying that Al-Sadr group is allied to Iran because we found some Iranian weapons with them is like saying that Al-Sadr movement is allied with the Soviet Union because they have AK-47s. It doesn't make any sense to link the political alliance to what type of weapons one group is buying from the black market. So I think there are two major groups in Iraq. One group that is allied with the U.S. and other powers like Iran, and the other group is against any type of foreign intervention, whether it came from Iran or from the U.S.
And I take it you're part of that last group.
Who?
I take it that you, Raed, are definitely part of the last group. You want an Iraq without any foreign intervention, whether it be the United States or Iran.
Well, why don't you invite me for another show to speak about my political beliefs?
Fair enough. Listen,
we're just talking about the situation on the ground without actually inserting what I believe in.
Okay, that's fair. Listen, I very much appreciate it. This is the kind of topic we could go on for many, many hours, but I have to tell you, I've learned more in a half an hour than I have in many months of studying this. So I really want to thank you for your analysis. I know my listeners do as well. I tried just to talk with you to get as much out as I could. I'll be talking with them in the next half hour. But thank you very much, Raed Jarar, for coming here on The Inside Scoop.
Thank you, and let's do that again soon.
I would like that. I would like that because it's very complex, and you do explain it well. Thank you again. And, folks, we're going to take a break, but if you want to call in and discuss what Raed Jarar had to say, we have the whole next half hour to do so. The toll-free number is 877-4-HEAD-ON, 877-443-2366. Anything about Iraq, what Mr. Jarar had to say, or anything about the Petraeus hearings, if you saw them yesterday, it's all up for grabs right here on The Inside Scoop. We'll be right back after this.
If you or someone close to you has a hearing loss, here is some great news. Thousands of Open Caption videos are yours to borrow, and it's all free. Open Caption videos make it possible for the hearing impaired to understand television. The Caption Media Program offers classic Hollywood movies, special interest, and educational videos. Visit us online at cfv.org or call 1-800-237-6213. You can register to be a user and make your selections from our online or printed catalog. It's just that easy, and we'll even pay for the postage. Open caption videos are perfect for the classroom, your home, or even the workplace. The nonprofit Caption Media Program is funded by the U.S. Department of Education and administered by the National Association of the Deaf. Tell a family member or a friend about the Caption Media Program today. Bookmark cfv.org for free loan open caption videos or call 1-800-237-6213.
I'm Matt Rothschild, the editor of the Progressive Magazine, with my progressive point of view, which you can also grab off our website over at progressive.org. John McCain didn't get the memo, either that or he simply wasn't paying attention when General Petraeus testified on Monday. Petraeus was careful to say that we haven't turned any corners, we haven't seen any lights at the end of the tunnel. But McCain was seeing them. He said, we're no longer staring into the abyss of defeat, and we can now look ahead to the genuine prospect of success. Petraeus said, the champagne bottle's been pushed to the back of the fridge. McCain said, success is within reach. The guy who doesn't understand the difference between Shiite and Sunni also doesn't get the difference between quagmire and victory. While McCain's remarks were atrocious and embarrassing, Hillary Clinton's and Obama's were just tepid. The American people really want our troops to come home now, a demand that one of the courageous protesters yelled out loud and clear at the hearing. But neither Clinton nor Obama was insisting on that. In fact, Obama sounded the retreat, not from Iraq, but from withdrawal. He said, I'm not suggesting that we yank all our troops out all the way. Silly me, I thought he had been suggesting that. I'm Matt Rothschild, and that's how I see it.
From Washington, more of the Inside Scoop with Mark Levine.
Welcome back to the Inside Scoop. I hope you enjoyed the first half of this show with my guest, Riad Jarrar, the Iraqi consultant for the American Friends Services Committee. It's very interesting getting his perspective as an Iraqi. This is a man who lived his entire life in Iraq, who lived in Baghdad, and then became a refugee in 2005 in America. So he has a unique sense of perspective that really you rarely hear on radio or television. Now, of course, with that unique sense of perspective comes an Iraqi accent. You can't blame the guy. English is not his first language. So I will try to convey what he had to say if you missed some of it, and then I definitely want to talk about the Petraeus hearings. Let me start with the Petraeus hearings, though, because I think it's crucial to understand the difference between what General Petraeus said and what Riad Jarrar had to say. If you listen, for example, to General Petraeus, he says, and this is a direct quote from the hearing, withdrawing too many forces too quickly could jeopardize the progress of the past year. We have the forces we need right now, I believe. We've got to continue. We have our teeth into the jugular, and we need to keep it there. John McCain echoed a lot of what General Petraeus had to say, saying, quote, Americans continue to risk everything to accomplish their mission on our behalf. Our behalf? Our? Who's our? Americans' behalf? McCain said, with the untold costs of their failure and the benefits offered by success, the Congress must not choose to lose. So the rhetoric of Petraeus and McCain is quite clear. There's Americans, and we're fighting for victory, and we're fighting against people who would take away that victory. We have our teeth into the jugular. We're trying our very hardest to succeed, and only Congress can make us lose. Did you catch any emptiness in the rhetoric there? Couldn't you say the same thing about any conflict anywhere on earth? Without, please, not absolutely comparing us to Hitler or Stalin or anyone else, because we're not that way. Still, couldn't you see them say exactly the same thing? What's notable about the rhetoric, whether it be from Petraeus or McCain, is how friggin' empty it is. We have to succeed. We have to win. Mission accomplished. We have to achieve victory. But the senators, including many Republicans, grilled General Petraeus yesterday, certainly the Democrats did, on what victory means, And Petraeus couldn't tell us. We have to fight on to succeed in doing something, and we don't know what it is. And as you heard from Ed Gerard, this stuff is complicated. It ain't like there are two sides, or three, or four, or six. A number of people are fighting each other for a number of different reasons. It's not just Sunni against Shia, as Ed Gerard was very clear to point out. There are different Sunni groups. There are different Shia groups. Some are supported by Iran. Some are supported by the United States. Some, like al-Sadr, are simply supporting of themselves. Some of them support a national Iraq. Riyad Gerard says that's the majority. Some of them support partition. There are Kurds and differences among them. There are a lot of different groups. And what is the American position? We just arm all of them. We'll just arm all of them or most of them. Anybody who will support us, we'll be happy to give taxpayer money to. In fact, there are people in Iraq, and this sounds, I know, this sounds like something crazy, but I have from many, many reliable sources, in the military, in Congress, we have people in Iraq that go there with bags of cash, literally go there with a heavy knapsack full of cash, and they just hand it out. Here you go, Mr. Warlord. Here you go, Mr. Government Person. Here you go, Mr. Person with al-Sadr. Here you go, al-Qaeda. That's right, al-Qaeda. George Bush is intentionally helping al-Qaeda, the same group that ostensibly killed 3,000 Americans. We're giving them bags of cash so they cooperate with us. We're arming all sides. We're paying off our side, all sides. Can you think of anything more counterproductive? The irony is that the al-Qaeda in Iraq has loose, if any, connections to the Osama bin Laden al-Qaeda that attacked and murdered 3,000 Americans while he sits pretty in the Pakistani-Afghani border region, because we don't have enough troops to go after him. What's al-Qaeda in Iraq? It's a bunch of Sunnis who don't want Shia control, and don't want American control, and don't want Iranian control, and so they've loosely affiliated with a Sunni group called al-Qaeda. But there was no al-Qaeda in Iraq before we invaded. So it's kind of really strange to call them al-Qaeda. These are local groups that affiliate with the larger organization just because it gives them a little more weight. It's kind of, frankly, like Crips and Bloods in the U.S. A bunch of kids doing what they want to do, and affiliating with some larger gang organization. And so what do? We help al-Qaeda against the Sunnis, against the Shia. And then al-Qaeda gets too strong in Anbar, so we use the surge, and we help the Shia against the Sunni. But in doing that, guess what? The Shia got too strong, and they're supported by Iran. So now, if you heard Petraeus yesterday, he's complaining that there's Shia militant groups that are fighting, and yes, there are, and they're attacking the Green Zone and so forth. And then what I found very interesting from Ra'ed Gerard is his complaint that the government, this wonderful democracy we're supposedly fighting for in Iraq, the government itself is not a democracy. Now, this was very interesting to me, and it's an argument I haven't heard before, and I'm going to explore more after this program is over. What he says is that while the Iraqi parliament represents more or less the Iraqi people, the executive branch, the president, if you will, it's a prime minister, does not. It would be like, hey, in America, this sounds very familiar, Congress representing the majority will, but the president doesn't. And as with our Congress, that requires two-thirds to impeach our president, remove him from office, what Ra'ed Gerard was saying is that it takes a two-thirds vote of parliament to remove their executive council from office, to do a no-confidence vote. And they don't have the votes. It's just amazing how close that is to our own system. And yet, that's not what it's supposed to be. A parliament, for anyone who studied parliamentary democracy, whether it be in Great Britain or Germany or Israel or Australia or Canada or anywhere else, the way a parliament works is majority rules. It is strict democracy. That's the way it's supposed to work. And if 51% of the parliament votes to get rid of the prime minister, he or she is gone. So Iraq does not have that direct democracy. Wonder who wrote that constitution. And lo and behold, the same government of Iraq that is getting so much money from the American government, the same government of Iraq that is sitting pretty in the green zone, protected by U.S. troops, and having the power it does solely because American GIs are fighting and dying on their behalf, guess what? They want the Americans there. But 70% of Iraqis, as Ed Gerard points out, don't. They want us gone. So it ends up being exactly like Vietnam, where we're supporting a government that does not have the support of its people. Now, I don't claim that it's as simple as Vietnam. Actually, Vietnam, get this, folks, is far simpler than Iraq. In Vietnam, there was pretty much us, and then there were the communists that were fighting against the government, led by Ho Chi Minh. In Iraq, there are many, many players. And that's one of the things I wanted to get across with Ra'ed Jarar. There are many, many players. And if you're confused about who's on whose side, then I have to admit, heck, I am too. It is confusing. There are many Shia groups. There are many Sunni groups. There are many Kurdish groups. There are nationalists, people that want Iraq to be one country. And there are partitionists who want it to be separated. But the real question, I think, comes, and this is the question I asked Ra'ed Jarar near the end, is what happens if we withdraw? Jarar thinks Iraqis will work it out themselves. He does not think there will be sectarian violence. He doesn't think people will be killing each other because, heck, they got along decently under Saddam Hussein. They can do it again. Is he right? I don't know. But, I mean, he's Iraqi. I'm not. So I think he probably knows a little bit more about it than I do or even the administration does. But look at it this way. If he's right, we can withdraw tomorrow. And whether we leave a tiny force beyond, you know, to protect U.S. interests, as frankly both Obama and Clinton support, I don't have a problem with that. And I'm talking about a tiny force, folks. I mean, taking 160,000 troops down to, you know, maybe 2,000, something like that. Not permanent military bases. But if we remove 99% of American troops, will the Iraqis go into a massive civil war? Ra'ed Jarar says no. And if he's right, we can leave tomorrow. Think of all the money we'll save. Think of all the lives we'll save. And let's say he's wrong. Let's say General Petraeus is right, and Iraq does engulf itself into civil war. Well, they'll just have to work it out. It won't be the first country involved in a civil war. Indeed, it may end up partitioned. It may be that the Shia and the Sunni fight themselves to a draw, and it ends up in partition. And if that's the way the Iraqi people want it, again, I got no problem with that. I really don't. Now, I've advocated in the past an independent Kurdistan. I do think the Kurds are a bit different from the rest of Iraq. Ra'ed Jarar, in fact, conceded that they have autonomy. But again, I don't know that it's for us to decide. See, the heart of the issue is, with all these groups fighting each other, it really reminds me of whether you look at the fall of the Soviet Union or the fall of Yugoslavia or, frankly, the partition of India and Pakistan or even the partition between Israel and the Arabs. In all these cases, in those cases, I'm not thinking, I don't know what's going to happen in Iraq, but in the case of Yugoslavia and the Soviet Union and India and Pakistan, and the Arab-Jewish separations, in all those cases, what did they do? They fought each other. There were bloody wars. And then people pretty much divided according to their ethnicities. There was, yes, ethnic cleansing. And it was terrible, but at the end of the day, it became stable precisely because of that fighting. In Baghdad, for example, as Ra'ed Jarar pointed out, admitted, already what was a mixed city has become separate according to Shia and Sunni. Now, I'm not saying that's a good thing. Please don't misunderstand me. I think it's terrible, in fact, that people who once lived together for many, many years and all the people like Ra'ed Jarar who are half Sunni and Shia have to switch sides. I hope that doesn't happen. Ra'ed Jarar tells us it won't happen, and I hope he's right. But if it does happen, again, it leads to a stability. There is a reason why in Europe the boundaries are not straight lines, and most French-speaking people live in France or Belgium or Switzerland, and most German-speaking people live in Germany, and most Italian-speaking people live in Italy. because different peoples have divided into different nation states. If the Shia and Sunni can get along in one state, terrific. If they can't, so be it. Either way, what are Americans doing there? What are Americans doing there? If they can work it out, terrific. That's what Red Gerard says will happen. If they can't, that's life. It's happened in the past. Pakistan and India are not friends, but they're not mostly fighting an active war against each other. What is victory in Iraq? What the heck are Petraeus and McCain even talking about? What is this victory that we are looking to succeed? Petraeus was on the stand for 8 hours yesterday, and he couldn't define it. He said, well, we can leave when the conditions allow us to leave. What does that mean? John McCain says success is within reach. What does that mean? As Raj Jawar points out, when we're talking about the Iranian influence, there's this idea that, oh, well, America is fighting against Shia militias controlled by Iran. That's the new problem now that we've helped al-Qaeda. Now we've helped the Shias against al-Qaeda. Now the Shias are too powerful. But as my guest pointed out, America's helping the government of Iraq, which is aligned with Iran, which is meeting with the Iranian president and in many ways doing the Iranian bidding. We are helping Iran. Indeed, our mere presence in Iraq is helping Iran by making our troops so weak that we couldn't oppose Iran if we wanted to. That's the other issue that's very interesting. I mean, even if, like Riad Jarar, you fear Iranian influence, and that's reasonable. I mean, you know, listen, there wouldn't have been any Iranian influence if we just left Saddam Hussein there because he protected against Iranian influence. But even if you do, Iran is just more powerful because we're there. I mean, we are bogged down there supposedly to fight Iran, but then we have all our troops there, and there's nothing we can do about it. It's interesting. I was reading an op-ed by David Ignatius in the Washington Post. And David Ignatius is generally, he's a realist, but he's generally conservative. He's generally the kind of person who supports taking a harsh line against Iran, taking a supportive of the Bush administration. But unlike, say, John McCain, he doesn't look at the world through rose-colored glasses. He admits the facts on the ground, if you will. Here's what David Ignatius had to say today. He said, don't pretend that, these are my words, not his, don't pretend that Petraeus is right about Iran suddenly getting involved in Iraq. What Ignatius writes is that Iran's covert campaign to reshape Iraq has been clear since the U.S. invasion of March 2003. It's nothing new. We have Iranian intelligence officials prepared lists of Iraqis for assassination. They sent Iranian-trained mullahs to take over the Shia mosques of central and southern Iraq. They pumped $12 million a week in covert financial support to their allies. They infiltrated all the major Shia political parties and many of the Sunni ones, too. This is all from David Ignatius. The Iranians have fixed the political game. They are on all sides at once. They have links to the prime minister, Nouri al-Maliki, and his Dawa party. They funnel money to the Badr organization of Abdul Aziz al-Hakim. You may have heard Jarar mention him, which is a key recruiting ground for the Iraqi army. They provide weapons, training, and command for Muqtada al-Sadr's Mahdi army. They are on all sides. And where is Muqtada al-Sadr? He's sitting in Iran, in the city of Qom. That, you know, that's not a good thing. So they have him in their control. The Iranians, Ignatius writes, were able to start the recent trouble in Basra and Baghdad through one set of operatives and then negotiate a ceasefire through another. Quote, in short, they play the Iraqi lyre on all its strings, unquote. Fighting a war, this is all from David Ignatius, again, this sort of conservative realist. Fighting a war against Iran is a bad idea. But fighting a proxy war against Iran in Iraq, where many of our key allies are manipulated by Iranian networks, may be even worse. The best argument for keeping American troops in Iraq is that it increases our leverage against Iran. But paradoxically, that's also a good argument for reducing U.S. troops to a level that is politically and militarily sustainable. It could give America greater freedom to maneuver in the tests with Iran that are ahead. Got that? So we're there supposedly to stop Iran, but we're putting all our eggs in one basket, and that just allows Iran to get more powerful. Again, if you were against Iranian influence, we shouldn't have invaded Iraq in the first place. If you were against Al-Qaeda influence, you shouldn't have been able to, we shouldn't have gone into Iraq in the first place. To answer Bob Kincaid's question, liar spelled L-Y-R-E, playing us like a musical instrument. Somehow, Ignatius writes, the next president will have to fuse U.S. military and diplomatic power to both engage Iran and set limits on its activities. A U.S.-Iranian dialogue is a necessary condition for future stability in the Middle East. But the wrong deal, negotiated by a weak America with a cocky Iran that thinks it's on a roll, would be a disaster. The one thing that the war in Iraq has succeeded, more than anything else, is helping our enemies. Al-Qaeda and Iran are both more powerful today because we're in Iraq. In other words, we are fighting over there to make them more powerful to fight us here. It is exactly the opposite of what George Bush said. We take a country under a stable dictatorship, a nasty guy like, frankly, pretty much all the dictators in the Middle East are, a lot less dangerous than, say, our good friend Saudi Arabia or our good friend Egypt, and we remove Saddam Hussein. We remove this balance of power, and then lo and behold, we're surprised when Al-Qaeda and Iran move in and take over and become more powerful. And whatever you thought about Saddam Hussein, he was less a danger to America and American interests than either Al-Qaeda or Iran. So what did we do? We removed this stable linchpin, Saddam Hussein, this very weak government that we were doing flyovers anyway, this guy who pretended to have WMDs because he was so weak that he had to scare people away when really he didn't have them. And what did we do? We removed him. And we made our enemies more powerful. And by staying in the region, we keep making our enemies even more powerful. And that's the thing here. This is not, I am not making a liberal argument. I'm not making a progressive argument here. A progressive argument would talk about the damage caused by war, would talk about the 1 million Iraqis dead, would talk about the 5 million Iraqis that are refugees, half outside their country, half within their country, would talk about the 4,000 American troops dead, would talk about the tens of thousands of American troops wounded, brutally wounded, losing an arm and a leg. We'll talk about the hundreds of thousands that suffer post-traumatic stress syndrome. We'll talk about the trillions of dollars we have thrown down the rat hole. That would be a progressive argument. I'm not making that argument. I don't need to. I'm making a pure, conservative, rationalist, self-defense American argument. If the goal is to fight our enemies, we've got to bring our troops home in Iraq, from Iraq. If the goal is to prevent Al-Qaeda and Iran from being more powerful in the region, we've got to bring our troops home from Iraq. If Riad Jarar is right, we will do it, and there will be peace. If he's wrong, they'll fight each other, our two enemies, there'll be war, and there'll be partition. Either way, we've got to bring the troops home. I hope you've enjoyed today's show. Tomorrow will be even more explosive, if that's possible. I'm going to take on one of the largest, probably the largest cult in all of America, the Church of Scientology. Don't miss tomorrow. We've got a really great show with a woman who attended the second highest level of the Church of Scientology, Tori Christman. That's tomorrow's show. For now, this is Mark Levine signing off.